Hi, this is Bill Overton. Outside of playing the game of baseball, the Negro League players and their teams had to manage the daunting and challenging task of traveling from city to city across the country. From an economic standpoint, this often meant playing many times a week in both large and small venues. Baseball historian Professor Leslie Heffey describes the concept of barnstorming.
So travel is a fascinating thing to think about. And so travel for Negro League teams, when you're talking about the Crawfords, the Grays, things like that, they had a sort of a twofold travel schedule. So you might have, I'll just say the Chicago American Giants, right? So they're going to play on Monday and Tuesday in Chicago. And their end goal is that on Friday and Saturday, they're going to be playing in New York City. So what do you do between traveling from Chicago to New York City? You play whatever games you can set up in whatever communities are available to you. So it might be Cleveland, so you play in the Cleveland Buckeyes, or it might be you're taking a little more of a circuitous route, and so you go down to go to Dayton, or you go to Zanesville. And so for a lot of Negro League teams, and this is something sometimes people, they might play literally maybe 70 or so games, 75 games, something like that, that are actual league games. And those aren't always played in the big cities because sometimes the two teams would come together, but more typically. And then the rest of the, 100 or so, 120 games that they played could be anywhere, right? And so lots of small communities, but that was the idea. You needed to fill your schedule and you needed to be, and part of the reason you needed to do that was because you needed to make enough money to keep the journey going. They played in lots of major league stadiums, but they also played in the high school stadium or they played in the local park, depending on what was available to them.
Pitcher Dennis Biddle describes the importance of the barnstorming games economically to the players.
We would play barnstorming games. Say we're going to Kansas City to play the Monarchs, Chicago. They would play two or three games in between that time. We call them barnstorming games. We call them money games because if you won, you got 60% of the gate. If you lost, you got 40% of the gate. And we couldn't afford to lose. We needed the money to travel on to the next stage. And this is how it was playing in the Negro League.
It depended on who was playing. It depended on what day of the week. And so trying to figure out how to optimize the money that you're making, right? As the owner was trying to figure out what days do you want to make sure that your team is in a big city and you're playing against a bigger opponent, because you might play a Friday, Saturday, Sunday set of games and make enough money that that's going to take you through the next couple of weeks. And so then the additional games are simply to supplement that, right? And it also depended on the team, because for example, the Kansas City Monarchs certainly historically had a much stronger financial backing than the Cuban Giants did. Hence the reason the Cuban Giants don't really have a home, right? They move almost year to year to find a different city to call home because they don't have that. So it also depended on the financial backing that they had.
Infielder Gerald Kasten remembers the many places the Negro League took him.
Because when I was playing in the Negro League, we faced some pretty good ball players and played against guys up in Pinocchio, Alberta, Canada, and Trinidad, Colorado, Whitefish, Montana, Crespin, Iowa, Missoula, but it was exciting. I really enjoyed it. I went to places that I don't think I would ever win if I had been in a major, little small town like that. They treated you well, and you got to get the city part of the United States. I went there to win the cent, so I enjoyed myself.
So for many of them, this is going to be the first time they've ever left the confines of where they have grown up, right? What they are used to, what they're comfortable with. And so, you're going to get a wide range of experiences that they're going to have, depending on how far they're going to travel. So, and where they're coming from. So if you think it's not about somebody like Hank Aaron, who's coming out of the South and is going to find his way traveling with these teams and in the Negro League part of his, he is 17 years old, right? Willie Mays is 17 years old when he, and they're going to suddenly leave the South to go up to Chicago and to go to Kansas City and something, and experience a world that they would not have gotten to experience otherwise. And that meant everything from these issues about travel. How is this going to happen? Who are you going to meet? To encountering often maybe more white fans than they have ever seen before, which is also going to mean they may hear things and see things that they had not expected to see.
I'm 17 years old. A lot of things I did not understand. I didn't understand why people would pay money to come in game, call us all kind of names. I didn't understand why after a game, we go to the hotel and said vacancy, and they tell us no. We couldn't eat in the restaurant. We had to eat and sleep on the bus. The bus was like home. This is the life of the Negro Baseball League, sir.
If you were from, like Buck Leonard when he came out of Rocky Mount in North Carolina, Black community, it was insulated. And so then you find yourself in a city like Chicago, and suddenly you're going to see these colored and white signs that you wouldn't have seen at home, right? And so in some ways, they're going to more readily experience the Jim Crow laws and the results of segregation than they would have otherwise. In addition to just the other side of it, the more positive side, which is getting to go to a big city and experience the jazz music and when they're not playing, to experience the fans, maybe the explosion of opportunities for new foods, all of those kind of things. I mean, the connection between a lot of these teams and the bars and places that where jazz musicians were playing, right? And getting to go here. These are incredibly exciting experiences for a 17, 18 year old that they would never have gotten otherwise. So there's both the positive and the negative sides of these travel experiences for them.
Pitcher Eugene Scruggs used the travel to appreciate home and as a learning experience.
Just riding all over the country, and you know, at that time, you know, school, after school, you know, that, you know, we would make up a game, you know, with the people in the community where I live. And so, you know, it was the experience of being on the bus and everything, you know, it made me think back at home, you know, in some place that we travel, like in Mississippi, you know, had cotton field, just like they had cotton field in Alabama and everything. And I can recall one time we was at the studying in our geography about the seven or eight Great Lakes and everything, and you know, that made me think about them when I was around the lakes and stuff, and it made me think about I can't think of the name. It's in Virginia where. You know, where the slaves, you know, were brought in.
Right.
And on the ground tunnel and all this stuff, you know, I've got you in to see it. And it was a great blessing, you know, that sometimes I thought I learned more about traveling around than I did at school.
Professor Leslie Heffey discusses the evolution of team travel from cars and the importance of the team bus.
By the 40s and 50s, you're going to see a little bit more of the bus than you did previously, but that was still not always the primary way that teams traveled. Buses were expensive. Buses were hard to come by for some of the teams. So what they tended to do more commonly was actually simply to pile in their cars. And so they might have five or six cars to which they're all, and so that meant, of course, that the players are doing the driving. So imagine, you know, playing a doubleheader and then having to jump in the car and drive all night to get to the next place where you're playing. When they had buses, typically, you know, you might have the trainer or somebody like that who's driving the bus. You wouldn't necessarily have a dedicated bus driver. The bus gave the advantage often of giving you a place to sleep, a little more room to, because often that's what they were doing. Buses also gave you the opportunity to air your uniforms out. They'd literally hang them out in the windows as they were going, and a lot more room to do that. Buses gave a little more camaraderie, a little more chance to, this is where you get, you know, Charlie Pride talking about singing on the bus and things like that when he was playing for Memphis. They could travel, you know, from New York all the way out to Kansas City and play everywhere in between.
Outfielder Sam Allen remembers his time riding the bus.
When you played in that Negro League, you traveled. I mean, you were just like a family. Yeah, you're on that bus. You slept on the bus, and we fight, you know, together. We did everything.
The bus was the team's safe haven, and oftentimes a last resort if the team could not find lodging. Jim Crow laws and racial segregation created many challenges as to where they could stay, and where to eat, and where to get gas for the teams who traveled across the country.
You know, prior to 1954, Brown versus Board of Ed, that whole notion of separate but equal ending, right? Even though I say ending, a piece of paper doesn't end it all, right? For a lot of the teams when they traveled, three biggest difficulties that didn't vary too much depending on where you were going was, where do you stay, where do you eat, and where do you get gas? And that last one may be a little easier to navigate than the other two. So what you have on the travel side, for example, with the question of where do you stay, oftentimes that was the job of the manager, the owner. Sometimes they had a traveling secretary whose responsibility was to try to figure out what towns are there places where we can stay. And what they were typically looking for are there Black-owned hotels, which you would find more in the South than you tended to find than in some of the northern cities, or are there homes where, and this is where the church sometimes came into play, where they could provide the address and the names of folks who were willing to put up ball players for a night, you know, because white hotels, you're just not going to be able to stay in. And the alternative to finding those was you have to sleep in the cars when you're traveling or in the bus. And that's where a bus certainly was an advantage over the other. And so that played a lot into, you sometimes wonder when you try to track a team's travel and you're like, why did they go that far out of their way? Well, that's probably why. They were looking for somewhere to sleep, somewhere where they would be welcomed. And then the other one, of course, would be, where do you get food? And so, again, finding Black-owned restaurants, which are a little easier to find both North and South, or having to go to white-owned restaurants, and you send either the lightest-skinned player that you have to try to bring out the meals, if you had somebody, or you had to go to the back and get served out of the back of the restaurant. And that was often the case where people had to do that. If you couldn't find families that were going to serve you, the church putting up a meal, that kind of thing. And so those restrictions really had an impact on where teams went. You know, if you went down to Louisiana and you were in New Orleans, you knew that there were a number of Black hotels. If you were in Pittsburgh, there were Black hotels. So you wanted to try to minimize the number of times you had to sleep in your vehicles, because that invariably led to some of the accidents sometimes, things like that. And then getting gas, I mean, something as simple as that is also sometimes difficult because not every place is going to serve. Or are you going to be able to get gas? And is that a stop where you can use the restrooms? Typically not, right? Because again, think about the colored signs and the white signs over the drinking fountains, things like that. So they're going to encounter all of those kinds of things, which made travel an adventure.
Here's outfielder Sam Allen from his interview with Ron Barr.
I know you remember stopping at restaurants and being denied access through the front door, and then you'd be directed to enter through the back door of the kitchen to get something to eat. And it was not uncommon to be refused restroom usage at service stations along the road. Did you all ever get used to that, or had it been going on for such a long time that you did get used to it?
Well, no, you didn't get used to it, but sometimes you didn't have any choice. If you got hungry, and especially if you played the night before and you struck out a couple of times, you needed to get a good meal for you. Some of the restaurants they had in the kitchen, they had a piece of plywood and some fish box in the kitchen. But what we would do in the kitchen, the cook looked like us, so we'd talk to her, and we'd get three plates in one. I know the man knew that she was doing that, he would kill all of us. But we sit back there in the kitchen and we eat up half his food.
Even when you could get a hotel, the places where the players were allowed to stay still created challenges for the players. Here again is outfielder San Al.
Well, I tell you, some of the funny moments I can say, when you went to a hotel, it was a good thing that just about every ballpark we went to had a shower. So you got a chance to shower. But when you went in the shower, you had a rubber where you put your money in and carry it in the shower with you, because if you left your money on the locker, somebody was going to clip you. And that was one of the things. And then when we went to a hotel, most of the hotels we went to, they had maybe 10 rooms on the floor and 2 bathrooms. And you'd have to stand in line sometimes 2 or 3 hours to get in the bathroom.
Oftentimes, young players had no idea of the struggles that players would face. Willie Mays recounts how his father had the foresight to make sure Willie was well looked after and had appropriate accommodations due to his age during his time in New York.
Well, my first year was kind of scary because I came to New York when I was about 19, just turned 20. And coming from Birmingham, Alabama, was very scary because New York, I had read about it, and I had played there for a couple of years with the Birmingham Black Barons. So coming back to New York, being a player and being a star in the outfield in New York, it was kind of scary. Well, my dad was a very smart guy. He was a guy that would stay ahead of me this way. When I went to Birmingham Black Barons at the age of around 15, he had already called the guys and told them to take care of me, not let me go out by myself anyway, not to be around fast people. So he already had told them what to do. So when I got to New York, he had called a guy named Joe Walker, which was a barber there, to make sure that I got a good room, make sure that I ate right, I didn't, go out too much. So he was the type of guy that was very low-key.
Author Jim Reisler recounts some of the writers who tried to tell the stories of the player struggles and how even Jackie Robinson continued to struggle with travel after he broke the color barrier.
They basically told it like it was. When they rode the buses, and they didn't travel a lot with the teams, but when they did, they would write sort of first-person stories about traveling conditions, and they would describe the crummy hotels people had to stay in. In a lot of cases, they were homes. They would describe the opportunities that weren't available to them. And most critically, it's interesting, when Jackie Robinson went to spring training with the Dodgers in 46-47 down in Florida, Jim Crow, Florida, everything Jackie Robinson did was news. I mean, he'd brush his teeth and it was news. And these black writers had a couple of them, Sam Lacy of the Baltimore Afro-American and Wendell Smith of the Pittsburgh Courier, really had special access to Robinson. They were as much sort of his mentors and his traveling companions as they were writers. But they would describe what he went through. And it's fascinating to go back and look at these articles and see sort of day by day what a guy like Robinson was going through. It wasn't just Jackie Robinson went 2 for 4 yesterday with a double in the 5th inning. It was what he went through when he sat down for lunch and what he went through when he was pulled over by the traffic cop. I mean, that kind of, they were advocates, but they really, really were very tough in describing what he went through.
We end our episode with the story from pitcher Gilbert Black, who discusses his memory of the bus and the 2 rules of playing for the Indianapolis Clowns.
Well, we had a bus. We had a bus, and the bus was somewhat segregated in a sense, not by color, but the higher echelon of players sat on the right side, and the lesser players, like the beer players, that sat on the left side, usually with 2 occupants in the seat. And I was lucky I was on the right side with the one occupant.
What was
me the... and King Tut, go ahead. Me and King Tut, Bebop, and so on and so forth.
What was the pay like for the players that played with the Indianapolis Clowns?
I made $250 a month. And our last game we played in Washington, D.C. in 1956, and the players were supposed to share the gate. And we would share the gate and get a percentage of the gate. I left with $40-some. I think it was $42. By the time I got home to Stamford, Connecticut, I was dead broke paying to get home. So we didn't make that much money, but we loved baseball, and we, kept playing. There was two rules on the Clowns, and that was hustle on the field and don't miss the bus.
Behind the Barrier, Voices from the Negro Leagues, is narrated by Bill Overton, produced by Taylor Haber. Executive producers are Jason Weichelt, Darren Peck, and Ron Barr. Please check out our next episode, as well as the episodes in this series. This series is distributed by Sports Byline USA and the 8-Side Network.